Thanks very much, Ian. Thank you all. Thanks for the invite. Yes, the Climate Institute, we're an independent research organisation. We are very focused on building a resilient Australia that's competitive in the emerging low-carbon economy, but also participating and doing its full share internationally. And that's actually very important. So the work we do here is always focused on how we telescope that into the international negotiations, into regional action as well. And so for that reason, we've been tracking the international talks for some time attend most of those. I unfortunately didn't go, so I'm not suffering from the jet lag, but we did send Erwin there. And if you didn't, he does do regular updates and did some video blogs, so we'll continue that next year in sunny Qatar, which is an interesting choice, not only for the football. What's the... I've got different things happening here and there, but I'm just going to do a brief overview and then have some discussions. But it's really, I guess, important to understand, and many of you would, that getting 194 countries together and having a consensus agreement mechanism makes things very challenging and very complex. We've described the outcomes from Durban as real progress. There are claims of both breakthrough and claims of failure. In our view, both of those are wrong. There are real progress, but no comfort either, so important to understand. And one of the things that's dominated people's understanding of approach to and interpretation of these talks has been what we call an outdated worldview that you need a treaty before there's domestic action. Now, to some degree, that was true when we looked at things like agreements regarding CFCs and others and the sort of heady days of the late 80s and early 90s. But the reality is that there is significant action happening worldwide. And that's happening for a variety of reasons. A fair chunk of that self-interest, but we have seen, as our colleagues in Bloomberg reported, that during the talks, the trillionth dollar in clean energy investments since they took records from 2004 took place. We have seen a steady increase in climate and clean energy policies that has continued to rise this decade and in the past decade. And so the reality is we're seeing on-ground action. And in fact, that actually, the significance of the domestic action also influenced the outcomes and jostling and positioning in the climate diplomacy. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But very important that we really are now in an action plus agreement phase. And so there's a shift that has to happen in people's heads about this. What do we need to actually boost that action? What we're seeing is action which has shifted the business as usual curve from one that would avoid 7 degrees warming to one that would head towards 7 degrees global warming to one that would head towards 3.5 degrees global warming. Now, for those of you who know both the commitments that all the countries have made, that's well short of the 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees commitments that countries have made, but would also know that 3.5 degrees warming is no solace whatsoever. We're still at very real risks there, and particularly of runaway climate change as well. So we need to do more, but it is an example that we have some significant action happening worldwide, just not sufficient. The economic self-interest reasons is a combination, and it's partly, you know, explaining China and South Korea and others. There are issues of local air pollution, there are issues of energy independence and security, as well as countries positioning themselves for those emerging and already growing clean energy markets globally, as well as concern around the climate. So what did we get out of Durban? Ross highlighted a few of those, but the headline element has been the agreement to a legally binding agreement. which is to be negotiated by 2015 but to take force from 2020. There's some ambiguity around the phrases, and there's protocol, legal instrument, and in what was literally a last-minute compromise, an outcome with legal force. Now, there's a whole bunch of interesting micro-geopolitics that happened there, but it is worth pausing to recognise that in the negotiations we had EU and the small island states emerging as champions for action. In fact, I was talking to someone just beforehand, and that Erwin was reporting that going into these negotiations, no one really expected there to be a legal agreement or agreement to one out of this talks. Everyone expected the EU to fold its cards and agree to a second commitment period, but without too much hullabaloo. Now, because they focused on some other challenges that they're having, but the reality is that they did stand up and joined with the small island states. Now, Australia's in a very interesting role. It chairs the umbrella group, a unique position where it heads the grouping of the negotiating bloc, which has the US and Canada and Japan and New Zealand, for example, and is really traditionally was the bloc outside of what was EU and what was traditionally called this G77, which was China and all the developing countries. Now, in Copenhagen, we saw that begin to break as the growth of the what are now called the basics, that's Brazil and South Africa, India and China countries, as they emerged, and tensions between those and the developing countries emerged as well. So it was a fracturing in some of the existing negotiating blocs. That continued in Cancun and then in Durban in a very interesting way. So we actually saw India trying to stand up to EU and the other countries who are arguing for a legally binding outcome and saying, we are developing countries, you trying to inhibit our development, only to be blindsided by Grenada and the other states saying, while you're developing, we're dying. And they didn't have much of an answer to that. And also, I guess it was important in trying to stare down the US and others, India and China were highlighting the fact that they actually have got significant domestic action happening. But what was interesting was that at the end of the day, the negotiating for that compromise phrase was actually between India and EU, who have got more credibility because of their domestic action. So I give those as examples of why the domestic action is important, not only around some of the outcomes, but actually also around the geopolitics. Ross talked about a couple of those elements that are there, but what we're seeing is an agreement to end it was started in Bali was a roadmap, and contrary to some people's views, there wasn't actually an agreement to an outcome, to define the outcome. There was an agreement to an outcome, but it wasn't defined. But what's happened in Durban was the first time that that's been defined as a single legal agreement binding all parties, which is a massive achievement. It has been a significant roadblock and a significant excuse for inaction for countries to say, oh, we can't just rely on you've got Kyoto, but nothing for other countries. And so it's actually a very significant achievement in itself to take away that excuse. So that's a very important one. There were very important developments in terms of institutions of global cooperation with the Green Climate Fund, and that's going to get going, I think, in April next year. The World Bank will be a trustee in the interim. There are still some issues about exactly the sources that are going to be driving into that, and there was some very interesting discussions around shipping and its role, but the International Maritime Organization will be coming back with some work on that. Some progress in other areas. Another area outside of this is in land use, where there was some developments using forward baselines, but there's some progress in some of these other other key areas. But most importantly, and this is important particularly for advocacy organisations and those who want to keep pressuring the governments in terms of the domestic action before 2020, because some have said this is just a deal for a deal, an agreement to talk, you know, for talks again for some action in 2020. But importantly, it was explicit recognition that the commitments that are there on the table are inadequate, set up a process for developing ambition, and that is part of the Durban platform process, how they're going to raise ambition. So it's a hook, an opportunity, which is important. Just to remind about the process and the history here, we have the UNFCCC emerging with the first of the carbon taxes. The Kyoto Protocol, when it was established, probably had about 25% coverage, but it's diminishing in its coverage while we saw the emergence there of some markets along the side. And so what we have now is actually moving into the sphere there where we have more than 80% global emissions. And it's kind of interesting that we, in a way, maybe in a year or two's time, we'll actually, Copenhagen may have lost its mantle of ignominy as a complete failure, because really Copenhagen was the juncture in which we started to head towards much broader coverage. We got the accord, which then got inscribed in the Cancun agreements, and what we are seeing now is that being built into the process for a single legal binding instrument, the commitments that countries have made and put on international record in Cancun are the basis and the basis for greater ambition. So we're seeing these markets emerge along the side. Obviously, California in Durban, China announced that its pilot emissions trading scheme in, I think, six or seven regions wouldn't be a baseline. One would be a cap and trade market. And there is still talk even of a national level market from 2015. How they, California and China are a bit of wild cards in the mix in terms of how much will they be trading internationally as well. And so that's a wild card into the international carbon price, of which there's been some speculation, and Seb also referred to earlier. So just last slide before I open up for discussions, really. Australia has positioned itself well in terms of these negotiations and with its clean energy future legislation. It didn't. I'm not saying there that it was covered in glory in Durban. It could have more clearly aligned with the island states and the EU, but it didn't. It does, though, play an important role in what's called the Cartagena Dialogue, which is a dialogue outside of those negotiating blocks. But importantly, it does have, and we're very much hopeful that it doesn't blow, the flexibility of the clean energy future legislation and the flexibility of the commitments, as Ross outlined, of going to the 25% target. That is, on our estimate, on Ross Garnaut's estimates, our fair share towards the 2-degree target. But remembering also that the countries, including Australia, agreed that we should even look at 1.5 degrees. So obviously we need the potential to even go more. And of course, that's towards a 450 ppm model, which is just a 50-50 chance of the 2 degrees. So having a flexibility beyond even that range is important, but maintaining that range, if I can paraphrase Gough Whitlam, is going to be a key a task, and one which we in particular will be focusing on in time ahead. EU and China are well positioned, and I think it's very interesting to watch EU in terms of its what it's doing with its carbon market. We saw overnight a number of the energy retailers and providers and other companies calling on EU to lift its target and to tighten the rules and bolster their EU price. Under the Danish presidency of the EU, there are some strong hopes and or expectations that its 20% target will be lifted to at least 25 or 30%. Now, I've talked about the emerging geopolitics, and I think, yeah, that, so the key thing is really that we need to continue to work to lift the ambition. In our view, though, Durban did represent real progress, but it's also no comfort. We've got plenty of work to do to build the markets and to build the ambition and the action that's needed to avoid dangerous climate change.